This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week on the show, Stephen McNeil talks about stepping down as Premier and retiring from politics. The Cape Breton Partnership is rolling out the welcome mat for newcomers on the island. And on The Good Sentence, a local musician teams up with a popular Canadian band for a European tour, but they had to cut it short and get back to Canada ASAP because of COVID-19. Stephen McNeil announced in August that he would step down as Premier and resign from politics after 17 years. He said he would stay on until his successor is chosen in the leadership election set for February 6th. In the running are former cabinet ministers Labby Kosulis, Ian Rankin, and Randy Delory. McNeil says he made the decision to step down before the arrival of COVID-19, not knowing of the challenges ahead. He says he hopes he's leaving the party in good shape to see it through. We're going to hear him talk about growing up in a family where he was the 12th child, with more on the way after him, about his mother's connection to Cape Breton, and how he hopes people on the island will remember him as the leader of the province.
So I live in the community that I grew up in. It was a community that was very good to me as in my family. My mother, who raised most of us after my dad passed away. So when I, you know, I then had children of my own and became involved in the community and really wanted to make a difference there. That really was the motivation to run. People encouraged me. I'd been involved in some organizations locally, minor hockey and local economic development committee. And so people just encouraged me to think about seeking public office. And I felt it was a way that I could actually add voice to the community that I live in. I never at the time thought about ever leading a political party or running to be the premier. It was really just to represent my community and my riding, and then obviously the opportunities came to actually lead the party, which I'm very grateful for.
Your decision to step down as Premier and say goodbye to politics heading into a new chapter of your life, was this influenced at all by the arrival of COVID-19 last year?
No, I had made the decision last year. No, I was actually going to go in April. I'd already decided that I was going to go home for Easter, but obviously the pandemic came in March and had to change that. And then when we had the bit of a lull in August, I felt it was the right time to communicate to Nova Scotians and to be honest, to the party, because the new leader will need some time to put their stamp on the government.
Where do you see the province going with COVID-19 and whoever becomes the new leader working with Dr. Strang? Do you think you left a good footprint for a smooth segue?
Listen, I would say this to not only the new leader, but I'd say this to political leaders around the world. Listen to public health, work with public health, take their advice. Obviously, you know, as a political leader, you obviously have a responsibility beyond that, but, you know, the economic future of a particular region, all that. But, you know, we went hard early at how do we control this virus, because it's my belief that if you don't have good public health, you won't have a good economy. So we did the tough decisions early on, and I would encourage the new person or anyone across the globe that if the virus is coming, whether it's a second or third wave, when you see it, be aggressive early on. Even though it may impact negatively to the economy, you can actually, by being aggressive at the front end, you can actually control the virus to a certain extent, which will then allow your economy to come out healthier at the other end.
We learned about the vaccine developments and distribution efforts a few weeks back. Do you feel the government is doing a good job in encouraging people to keep their guard up? Because, as Dr. Strang said, basically a vaccine is not the silver bullet in putting an end to COVID-19.
Well, and it's also, that's very true, but the other part of that is also, even though the vaccine is rolling out, we're going to be quite some time before we vaccinate enough people that we'll be able to deal with that. The most critical thing for all of us as we wait for this vaccine to come and wait our turn to get the vaccine is that we do continue to follow the public health protocols, you know, washing your hands, keeping your distance, wearing a mask. Those are continued things that we need to continue to do, and of course we'll still communicate that to Nova Scotians.
Something that really made an impact on people during your time dealing with COVID, Stay the Blazes Home. Where did this come from, and did you realize it would be on things like coffee mugs and t-shirts eventually?
No, actually my chief of staff, Lori Graham, actually a good Care Brightoner, very proud of her heritage in Care Brighton. We were preparing remarks one day, and she said, do you ever say this? I said, and then of course I had a more colorful version of that, where she said, you're not allowed to say that. I said, well, you know what? I've heard my mother, who's also a K-Rutner, use those phrases. Oftentimes it was get the Blazes outdoors as opposed to stay the Blazes home, but, it came as a team effort, and, when I communicated it, I had no idea it was going to take off the way it did.
Speaking of your mom, you mentioned you wanted to spend more time with your family after retiring from politics, and you were one of 17 children, and I believe you were number 12 on the roster. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
What was it like growing up with so many brothers and sisters, the average family now being much smaller than that?
Well, I have two. You know what? I didn't know any different. It was wonderful. You know, my mother is... has always been the rock that I stood on, and I don't think it's unique for me. I think our siblings, all of us, for most of us, she became both of our parents when our dad died. She took on really dual roles. Admired her. One of the things that I didn't realize, because it was never something that was in our world, was this whole issue of gender inequality. Our mother was everything to us. There was nothing that we believed she couldn't do, and quite frankly, nor my sisters. They were, you know, every bit as equal to us. In many ways, the boys had to do a lot of time catching up to the girls. But so it was never, you know, this whole gender inequality was a big surprise to me when I came here. Because it was just not part of our life, and that was mom and my sisters who have been such an inspiration for me.
You know, a lot of parents would tell you they have their hands full with one or two kids, but your mother must have been up for that challenge. And just looking here, she was the first female high sheriff in Canada. What does that position entail, and are there some common skills there that would help her in taking care of 17 children?
So I would say my mother, if she was here, would probably say to you someday she felt she had it easier than someone with two small kids, because the older ones would help. She was definitely the one in charge, but you know, my older siblings would do and help with kids and making sure that we were fed and all those kinds of things. We all would arrive home at different times because of our age gaps, and so you know, we were pretty busy household in the sense of people coming and going. But my mother always used to say, you know, someone who was left with two small children and in some cases had it harder than she did, because obviously they were, you know, trying to manage that, where in her case she could, one of the older kids could help out. The job as high sheriff is one of those that when my mother was doing that job, you actually used your own car, so the car that she would take us to church in or take us to school, wherever, would be the one that she would use for work, and you would go and serve papers from the courts, execute those. And if you were, you know, been in a sentence to a correctional facility, whether it be one of ours or a federal institution, she'd put you in the back seat of her car, and the deputy sheriff would go with them, and they would drop you off. So it was nothing for her to take someone to, you know, whether it was our own Kings County Correctional Facility, the one in Dartmouth, or quite frankly, federal penitentiaries in New Brunswick, where she would take you to Dorchester if you had been sentenced there.
If we can go back a few years, of course, some controversies along the way when you and your colleagues would butt heads with the opposition and the unions, and one of those discussions about 7 years ago with the nurses, they wanted better conditions, but the government supporting legislation to end their strike, was it difficult to bounce back in dealing with the unions? And now with COVID-19, we see again how important the role is they play in the community.
No, it's when you're you're trying to balance, you know, the fiscal situation of a province, it does, is there no way is that you don't respect the position that people have or what they're doing. It really came down to just our capacity to pay. And then how do we best do that across the entire sector? I'm proud of the fact that our economy is actually, prior to COVID, had never been stronger. Population was at an all-time high, more young people were living here. We had diversified job opportunities. But in order to do that, we needed the capacity fiscally to be able to make some investments, whether it was graduate opportunities where we helped subsidize a job for a university or college graduate, or other investments we made around diversifying, whether the investment we made in Holy Angels Church, where we, you know, where we see a tremendous number of private sector entrepreneurs working there. We couldn't do that if we used up all of the money that we had to pay public sector workers. There was a balance. We didn't take anything from anyone. We just felt that those increases were reflective of our ability to pay. At the same time, we were using some of the other public money to invest in other job opportunities.
Another, many average workers probably didn't have a problem with this with the February holiday, but businesses were concerned about the economy taking a hit with a day off for their workers because of a holiday. How do you go about deciding between the value of spending time with your family versus the value of your bank account?
So, you know, we have one of the fewest holidays in the country, stat holidays. So the February holiday really was something Diana Whelan, who had been pushing for really from opposition and we went into government. You know, I come from an entrepreneur background. I was self-employed prior to this job. But it really was striking the balance of what is the best way you know, to find that break in the winter from New Year's through to March break and February holiday, which we're starting to see across the country, made sense. I'm really proud that we have it as Heritage Day and that each year we recognize an individual who's that we try to move their story as part of our education system that year. So Nova Scotians, in particular, our youth learn more about you know, these figures who've helped shape our province and our country.
Did you feel at times, you know, it's exhausting making decisions when you deal with issues like this? You certainly can't make everyone happy regardless of what you do at the end of the day.
Listen, I don't leave home and make everybody happy. I've never, you know what, I truly tried to do what I thought was right, and then what the decisions would be, what people felt would be what they felt. I tried to articulate why I was making them the best I could. And I just, you know, you don't get to do this job forever, and I wanted to make sure that when I left, I felt good about the fact that I was true to who I was and true to all Nova Scotians, that I was going to make decisions that I thought was in our collective best interest and not in the interest of just a few of us.
So going into a new chapter where your itinerary doesn't involve being a public figure, what kind of effort will it take to decompress and go at a different pace?
I don't know if there certainly will be one that I'll, you know, I'm going to spend some time post-February preparing myself for whatever's next and preparing my family for me being around a bit more. But yeah, no, I'm going to take some time to rest, but I'm definitely going to go do something else. I don't know what that is yet. But I will take some time to rest. This has been 17 years for me. I've been the premier for seven, but I've led our party since 2007, and you know, I was on the road most weekends, nights, here, you know, driving around trying to prepare the party for every election. And so I'm looking forward to a bit of a change of pace, something different. But yeah, I will take some time for sure to rest.
So do you have any hobbies or projects on the back burner you've been looking forward to tackle?
So, well, I built a garage about 30 years ago. My father-in-law and I went on the woodlot, and he had a sawmill, and we milled it out. And I built that garage 30 years ago. It's finished on the outside, but it's not on the inside. And that is my project that I'll do. My number one project will be to finish wiring that the shop, and then actually finish insulating and doing the inside of it. So I enjoy that, and have some of the boys around, and I'll make sure there's a few beer in the fridge when they're working, so like so they can actually. I'll make sure they're enjoying doing it.
That's a sure way to get people over. How would you like Cape Bretoners to remember you after your years in public office? So what's the legacy you'd like to leave behind for it?
So my mother's a Cape Bretoner. Ironically, it's my mother's maiden name was Mumbercat, from a little community called Lower Lordways in Richmond County. The McNeil side of my family came through near Soldiers Cove in the early 1800s, but my dad was raised in Halifax. But I hope Cape Bretoners think about the fact that I was fair to them, that I treated them with respect. Didn't always agree with them. They didn't always agree with me. The transformation I'm trying to make around healthcare isn't about yesterday. It's about tomorrow and the future decades ahead. I hope they look at the community college as what I believe it will be, a great institution to educate the kids down in Sydney, but it'll also be a good economic driver. I just hope I hope they felt that I was fair to them and true to them. They're tremendous. It's a tremendous part of our province. The people are proud. They're hardworking, and I was thrilled to be their premier, Minister McClellan. Minister Mumbercat represented the island well in our government, and. I just hope they thought I was fair with them.
The Cape Breton Partnership has launched a new program to welcome newcomers to the island. The Cape Breton Welcome Network is a volunteer-driven program designed to help people get settled in when they arrive while showing them one of the things the island is most famous for, the friendliness of its people. We caught up with Norma Jean McPhee to talk about the new program.
The Cape Breton Welcome Network is a grouping, or what we're calling a constellation, of local volunteer-led welcome groups. So the welcome groups are really the heart of the entire Cape Breton Welcome Network. And the hope is that with these welcome groups within them, there's all kinds of volunteers, and they're the ones that make the contact with the newcomers. And having a Cape Breton Welcome Network, an overarching network, allows all of the groups to be connected and learn from each other and learn with each other, and also allows for promotion of the entire network as a whole.
And there are six welcome groups across the island. Where are they?
So the current six welcome groups are, you're right, are located all across the island. So there's one in St. Peter's, one in the Cape Breton Regional Municipality. There's one in Victoria County. There's another one in Port Hood, one in Judic, one in Shetty Camp. But these welcome groups have formed from the interest of volunteers in these particular areas. So in Judic and Port Hood and St. Peter's, people came forward, volunteers, because they wanted to form a group that would indeed be able to welcome newcomers. And I'm sure there are many other groups across the island who, or groupings of people, or, you know, perhaps people listening to our chat who say, oh, that's a great idea. How can we help? And so what we suggest is three or four, maybe five volunteers from a particular area, and then they can get in touch with us on our website. And then from there, you can form your own welcome group. Currently, there's one big group in the Cape Breton Regional Municipality, but that doesn't mean there couldn't in the future be a welcome group on the north side or a welcome group in Lewisburg. That doesn't need to stay just the six that exist. So we definitely encourage groups of people, or if there's already a community group that is doing similar, you know, economic development or other community activities, and they want to bring welcoming newcomers as part of what they're doing, it doesn't need to be a brand new group. It could be an existing group who wants to take this on as part of their mission as well. So we welcome all folks who want to help us out with growing this Cape Breton Welcome Network.
Your group is stressing that everyone can be an ambassador in welcoming people, new people to the area, even with a simple gesture like a wave or a handshake or something like that, that it can really go a long way.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, it can be, you know, over a cup of coffee, you know, tell someone, you know, where the best mechanic is or a great place to go get your haircut. It's kind of the goal and what we see as the gap that the Welcome Network is filling is the social connection, kind of that fabric of a community that new folks to an area just they don't get right away necessarily. That you know may eventually come as they reach out and make friends and join things themselves. But the intention of this through the network and all of the individual welcome groups is that the volunteers can reach out to the newcomers and when the newcomers reach out to them and just, yeah, have those chats, you know, where can my child sign up for soccer or what's the best trail or where can I go skydiving? You know, just ask those questions from, you know, as we know from even like traveling the world back when we used to be able to travel the world, you know, you always in travel books and write-ups, you want that insider's track or insider's guide to whatever city you're discovering. And that's essentially what we're hoping to provide and aiming to provide to newcomers is that insider's glimpse to their own community so that it becomes their community very fast and they feel part of that community.
And being part of the community, what kind of effort goes into helping people adjust as far as customs here on the island or traditions and making people feel welcome? Do newcomers feel pressure to set aside their own customs or is there more of a willingness to share ideas?
From what I've experienced is that there's a great willingness to share ideas in terms of, you know, people, say, in Shitty Camp wanting to share their French heritage, but also a willingness to learn from, there's two or three Syrian families that have just arrived there in the last several months. And there's, you know, great interest on both sides of, you know, trying to learn each other's languages. And not just the languages, because that's just kind of almost like the entryway into somebody's customs and traditions and cultural traditions that they cherish, you know. But I think it's celebrating each other's backgrounds and that's where the diversity and that richness comes out of. And sure, there might be, you know, sometimes there's fear of the unknown, potentially, but I think by having more interaction with everybody and chatting about how these differences actually enhance our community and really add to the diversity of not just the diversity of the people that you see, but it's the ideas, it's their lived experience, it's those stories, it's learning the stories of each other. So it becomes a two-way sharing of life with each other and just learning with each other.
Not everyone, obviously, is welcoming as people in these groups, and some people aren't the biggest fans of change, but if a newcomer finds themselves in an awkward or less than flattering situation, they may feel offended. What should the response be to encourage them? It's not an overall reflection of the people in Cape Breton.
Well, I guess it would just be to encourage them to continue to reach out to meet other people and meet new people. I see what you mean. One bad experience can last and can stick with someone, but it will be that encouraging of various folks within the community. And I firmly believe that, you know, if encouraging the positive, more positive comes out. And if somebody does encounter an unfortunate situation, then it's, you know, not just with words, not just saying, oh, it'll be okay, but really truly showing them, well, actually, I'm going to bring you to an event where you're going to meet all kinds of great people. Well, these days it might be an online event, but or go for a walk in a park or safely distance with a group of people that there's some commonalities in. Because we all have commonalities, no matter where we're from or what our backgrounds are, we all, you know, most people anyway, want to be, you know, connected with friends and family and we have food in common and music, and it's often those cultural, you know, interactions that people can share in terms of the commonality, but also the subtle differences, and that's what makes it so interesting.
And what do you hear from the people new to the area about the scenery and landscape here in Cape Breton when you're showing them the best of what the island has to offer, like you mentioned, food and music and whatnot? The scenery must be really breathtaking for people who aren't used to this type of landscape.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously I've met newcomers in my own life previous to the Cape Breton Welcome Network. But at this point, the groups are still connecting with newcomers because we spent a lot of time in the early months getting the groups established and started and supported. So now is when they're starting to make those connections with the newcomers. But I have heard personally just from two or three different emails with people in the last few weeks, even just how, you know, one woman spent her summer in Margaree and another is living in Port Hood right now and she's a photographer. So, you know, it is our natural, amazing landscape that if and when we live here, we get used to it in a great way. But it is definitely breathtaking in a lovely way for new folks here as well.
What about provincial cabinet representatives responsible for immigration? Would a project like this tie in with the government's efforts to boost population and dealing with things like an aging population and boosting the economy and so on, things like that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's no secret to anyone when people are happier and healthier where they're located, then they can fully participate. And it is, you know, it is definitely part of retention is when somebody arrives in a new location, you know, if they enjoy where they're at, they're going to stay, and that inevitably will happily boost population and therefore boost the economy too, because you know, many, many new folks arriving in our communities have lots of business degrees or other degrees or want to start new businesses. So there's those sort of developments as well. And specifically, actually, it's the Nova Scotia Office of Immigration that is supporting this Cape Breton Welcome Network currently. So they already see that value because it's not just about funding new businesses, but it's supporting those people that arrive in our province and supporting them in all ways that we can so that they are happy and fulfilled and supported and connected. And it's then that they'll stay, they'll, you know, have families here and really not just contribute to the economy because that's good for the economy, but contribute to the economy because they're happy in doing it and really feel part of their community.
What's on the top of the list for people when they get here? Is it looking for housing or are they looking for ways to, you know, connect with, you know, potential new friends, and maybe they already have some family here too, but what's the first thing they like to do?
Well, again, from what I understand and the interactions with the newcomers coming to Cape Breton in terms of this program are just getting going, but it's what probably any of us would be interested in when we arrive somewhere new. It is finding the housing, finding employment. But beyond that, it is making those connections within their community, making some friends, you know, joining perhaps a sports team or singing lessons or, you know, those things that when we as individuals go home in the evening or on your lunch break, what are those things that you do for your own fulfillment beyond your work day? And that is what people look for. And they do look, you know, they look for that in their new home. Yeah, it's continuing to grow and hopefully it will just, you know, more, as I think as more and more people learn about it and about what's, you know, the potential of the groups, we'll get more volunteers and also, of course, having those newcomers make the connections too. And that's kind of the heart of it all, is having that those local connections made.
And for anyone interested in volunteering, what should they do?
They should check out our website, which is welcometocapebreton.ca. And on that, they can click right on the Cape Breton Welcome Network page. And on that is lots of information about the six different welcome groups, and they can connect with the welcome group chairs. So whether they want to volunteer or if they are a newcomer who would like to be welcomed, they can check out the website and or email at welcomenetwork@capebretonpartnership.com.
Today on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, a chat with Nathan Hines of the local heavy rocking band Keith Doom and the Wrecking Crew. Nathan got the chance of a lifetime to tour in Europe as a roadie with Canada's longest touring heavy metal rock band Anvil last February, only to have the tour cut short in March by COVID-19.
So, Nathan, why don't you, before we get into your adventures with Anvil during the early days of the pandemic, tell us a little bit about yourself and your own musical interests and your band and all that. Give us a little intro to yourself.
You know, I got into music when I was, you know, as old far back as I can remember from my father, you know, like classic rock stuff. And, you know, I started going to local shows when I was a teenager and picking up on all kinds of different genres. I was going to more and more shows. And then when I was 19 or 20, I started my own band, Keith Doom and the Wrecking Crew. Because that's just what a lot of my older brother's friends called me in, when I was in high school, Keith Doom. I don't really know why. You know, we did lots of playing around the Maritimes, like Halifax and here, Moncton, Fredericton, everywhere around there, different festivals. And, you know, and that kind of helped lead into the whole thing with Anvil was two springs ago. They played a back-to-back in Sydney Mines, and I went to the first night, and I opened the second night. I kind of got hooked up with those guys. They needed a roadie, and I just made a last minute decision to do a month and a half long Canadian run with them, running all their equipment and setting everything up and making sure things were going smooth. And that led to this past spring being offered to go over to Europe with them for what was supposed to be about a 3 or 3.5 month run or whatever it was, a really intense run of shows. And obviously COVID chopped that pretty heavily.
So, when you did your Canadian stint traveling with them, that would have been in what, like 2019, I guess, right?
Yeah, it would have been the back half of,
yeah,
or the first half of 2019, like would have been April or May,
okay,
late April into May.
So then, somewhere a few months later or whatever, you get this call and they I take it it's from Steve Kudlow, right? The front,
yep,
man. They call Lips, right? They still call him,
yep,
that?
Oh yeah, they still call him Lips.
So anyway, he asks you if you want to go to like Europe for 3-4 months. Is that kind of like what happened?
Basically, like, you know, at the end of the Canadian run, the day before I flew back to Sydney, we're just kind of, I was just at Lips' house, and, you know, he's telling me, you know, thanks for helping us out and everything. I'm like, yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity, because it was great. You know, I got to see a lot of my own country that I never got to see, lots of little places here and between and everywhere else. And and he kind of said, you know, there might be more opportunities for you with us, and, you know, we got along good, you're a good worker, you know, so I'll give you a call sometime. And I'm like, all right. So I'd say about the next fall-ish, he gave me a call and, you know, yeah, basically just said, listen, we're doing the big European tour. It's the biggest one we've done in a couple of years. He said, we need you if you can do it. And, you know, we need young guys that want to do this. And I said, sure. And he said, and if you have a buddy you want to bring, perfect, because we need, you're gonna need help. And the label said, you know, it was fine, I could just bring whoever. I brought my friend Tanner Ludi,
who's your guitar player, right?
Yeah, and he's the guitar player in my band.
Yeah.
And you know, and off we went, you know, just in about a year ago, you know, it was like the February 14th or something, I feel like. It was mid-February we left last year.
Now this, you know, so this is kind of a tour, a mega tour, really. I mean, we'll get to where you went, or we're going to go, but it was like numerous sets back-to-back, different countries in Europe, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was a lot of back-to-back. Like, you know, we only really made it, you know, about a month-ish, and we only had, I think, one day off in there for a kind of a lengthier travel day. You know, there was a lot of just every night go, go, go. And then, you know, when you're over in especially like a place like the UK, like, it's still so club oriented, like how America and Canada used to be with live music. Like, not that it's still, not that it isn't here, but not quite as like how it is over there. Like a good mid sized, good drawing band like Anvil, you know, plays a club that's, you know, no bigger than a Legion Hall here and packs it. And you just do that every night in every little town, and, you know, you sell a lot of merch, and you meet a lot of people, and it's like a blitzkrieg of a time, but it is really fun, and the hard work is worth it, because, you know, you got to get up early, do everything with the venue, you got to eat, you got to make sure you got a good routine going, but by the end of the night, you're sitting on the tour bus, and you're, you know, you might be a little tired, but you're happy, and, you know, you've maybe met some new friends, and everyone's talking, and everyone's kind of, you know, the band is hyped up after the show. So it's a really unique experience, right?
Was this your first time to Europe?
Yeah, first time leaving the country, yeah.
Well, what an, kind of like Nathan and Tanner's Excellent Adventure, really.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
I felt like that sometimes.
I bet. So they get this massive tour in Europe, and then so come about March, though, and you're there with them, then you start really hearing about the pandemic, right? So why don't you tell us a bit about all that?
Going over, we knew about it, right? Like, you know, by that point in February, it was kind of in the media, mystery flu or disease in Wuhan. They didn't even have a name for it, right? It was like, you know, 40 people are sick, and Wuhan is doing this and that, and it was like, oh, wow. But there wasn't cases, like, anywhere else. And then it's like, you know, by the time we're leaving to go there, it's like, okay, there's a couple cases of this in Europe, in Italy. It's where, you know, where it really first broke. And I think there might have been one or two in France that had, like, recovered or something. And, you know, we're thinking about it, but I was, you know, so amped up on the whole experience. It was like back way in the back of my mind. And within 2 days of the tour, we totally lost all the Italian dates, which would have been at the end of the tour. But we're just kind of, even the Italian promoter was just saying, like, this is only temporary, blah blah blah, but, you know, so you might get these dates back. And we're like, oh yeah, we're for sure making it there, like, this isn't really a big deal, like. And it was almost like a movie, like, foreshadowing. Like, everywhere I went, I wouldn't be paying attention to a TV, like, at a restaurant. But, you know, I might glance up at it, and it's a news report about COVID every time. And it's like, you know, whatever. It's not a big deal. And, you know, a week goes by, and it's, you know, everything's going great. The shows are packed. You're meeting people. You're shaking hands. Like, there was no, like, social distance and don't touch and blah blah blah. You know, we were a little extra cleanly and stuff like that. And then by the time we were, like, you know, wrapping up the second week, it started to get like really serious really fast. Like, we were in Belfast one night and had a great show and a good time. We were there for two nights, and then we get to Dublin, and it's real early in the morning, like 7-8 in the morning. And there's a laundromat connected to the venue, so I'm trying to get my laundry done because I didn't have that much clothes with me. And the venue promoter's in talking to me, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to go upstairs. I've got to do something in my office. I'll unlock the doors. We can get set up. It's like, perfect. And he kind of goes for, like, about 40 minutes. I'm like, where is this guy? And he comes down. He's like, you guys got to get out of Ireland. They're totally locking it down. They're going to cut the ferries and everything. And we're like, what? Really? Like, why? What's happening? And he's like, with the COVID, like, they're, you know, we got a few cases. They're locking it down. They're preemptive kind of strike, which is, you know, good that they did that. But it just, that's when it really was like, okay, this is really, really bad. Like, you know, there was other times where, you know, we encountered other bands who were out on tour that, you know, and it didn't even come up in conversation, like, oh, did you guys lose any shows or this or that? Like, with some of the supporting bands that were doing their tours and then intermingled opening for Ambil and stuff. But we were on the ferry initially to the UK from France. It was the first time we talked to anyone about it, even the bands Testament, Exodus, and Death Angel, who were, you know, all very big, like, Bay Area thrash bands.
Yeah.
They were on tour, and we were all on the same ferry together at about 6 a.m. eating breakfast, and know the Anvil guys a bit, and Lips wasn't there. I think he stayed on the bus asleep, but, you know, and they're talking to Robbo, and, you know, I love these bands since I was a teenager, and I've seen a lot of them live and stuff, so, you know, I was pretty excited to talk to these guys, and, you know, they're like, yeah, we lost some dates in Spain and Italy, but we're going to go finish our UK stuff and blah, 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 and it's like, yeah, right on. And they get, you know, I'm reading a week and a half later, like, the drummer from Death Angel is in a coma with COVID, and they're all back in the U.S. in total lockdown and this and that. And I'm like, oh, I was only talking to those guys like a week and a half ago. And then they're saying, you know, this big incubation period with the disease and everything. And I'm like, great, I'm going to get COVID now. You know, and, you know, knock wood, none of us got sick. And, you know, and it ended up, none of us got sick with it. You know, whether we had it or not at any point and were asymptomatic, I'll never know, right? It's so early, but,
yeah.
You know, by the time we were into that, like, third week, it was like, you know, we'd be at the venue at some random town in the UK, and it'd be like, yeah, we sold 500 tickets, and 50 people showed up. And we were just sitting on the bus one night, and Lips said, you know, I'm getting on the phone with the travel agency tomorrow, and we're going to try to sort a day to get out next week. We'll finish up the UK dates. And it seemed reasonable enough. Like, we're still playing, like, we still had, like, London to play and, like, Bristol and some bigger places. And that next morning, I woke up to Lips and Robbo on the phone losing it on someone. And, you know, all our flights back to the country were going to be WestJet, and WestJet just totally pulled all their flights. So at that moment, we had no way back into the country. So, you know, Lips is on the phone all day getting this sorted, you know, and, you know, I thank him for it. But just to get us all back to where we were going, and, like, it was a nightmare for him. Like, they were, the travel agencies had no clue how to help us, because every company was pulling flights, and flights were getting sold out because everybody was getting out of Dodge, right? If you weren't from there, you were gone. You know, it was so early, too, that it was like, what's going to happen when I do get back in Canada? Like, you know, they're just starting to say, like, you got to quarantine and this and that, and, you know, obviously we got it all figured out, but it was a really stressful time. And on top of that, that night they still had to play a final show. And, you know, there was maybe, yeah, like 50, 60 people there out of what should have been a few hundred or whatever in this little town, Swindon. And that's where we ended our stint. It's, I don't even really know where Swindon is. Kind of near Birmingham, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
Might be wrong about that. And, you know, that ended up just being such a whatever, like, get me out of here, this little nothing town, and get me back into Canada. But originally, the Swindon date was probably the one that everyone was looking forward to the most, because, you know, this is how fast everything happened. About a week and a half prior, Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull got a hold of Lips and said, you know, I'd love to come see your guys' sound check when you're in Swindon. That's where I live. And meet everybody. And because he met them in an airport, I guess, years ago, and told them, basically, I'm restarting Jethro Tull as a touring band again because I seen your guys' documentary and realized, you know, how grateful I was for having a very successful band, blah, blah, blah.
You're kidding.
And he wouldn't come out because he's got, like, from what I understand, like a COPD kind of, like a respiratory illness, so he really couldn't chance COVID. So that was pretty upsetting for those guys because, you know, them being, you know, 70s rockers, they're big Jethro Tull fans, and as were me and Tanner and everybody else in the crew, like, that would have been a really interesting guy to meet, right? Would have been me and Anderson. And that's, you know, that got swept, the tour got swept, and it was all in a blink of an eye, right? Very fast.
So you got back sometime in March to Sydney?
Middle of March.
Yeah.
And
then you went to your folks that arranged a quarantine room for you.
Yeah, the Beacon Motel.
The Beacon out in Sydney River there.
Yeah, right across from the rink.
Yeah, wow, 2 weeks
the
there.
Owner stuff.
You were probably one of the first people that, you know, that was getting back and then going into those quarantines, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I was so worried that I had COVID, right? Going through these airports and, like, no one had masks or anything.
No.
You couldn't get masks. You couldn't get the hand sanitizer shortage was a thing there for a second. So it was like, you know, I'm like, got my shirt up over my face on the plane and people are giving me weird looks. But it's like, you know, we're on a sold out Air Canada, like, flight. And it's like, I don't know who's got this here.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
You know, and people were like, oh, like, you know, I was like talking to people, messaging me, being like, when you get back to the country, like, I think they might like arrest you or this or that. I was like, what? Like, what? Like, what's going to happen to me when I get home? And we land in Toronto, and yeah, they gave me a little piece of paper, and it said, like, wash your hands, and if you think you're sick, don't go near anyone. That's all they did, right?
Yeah.
And I called my parents right when I got in Toronto. It was like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And I just said, hey, yeah, I'm back in the country. And my parents were obviously really relieved. And I said, you know, I have no clue what to do, though. Like, when I get back to Sydney, I said, you know, we're going to spend the night in Toronto, and then our flights are in the morning back to like, Halifax and Sydney. I'll be home by 4 o'clock in the evening. And my mom was like, well, we'll leave the house. I'll leave your key in the mailbox. You just go right up to your room. I said, I don't think it's going to work like that, though. But I really think I actually got to be, like, locked down, and Dad went and figured it out, right? And it was a long 2 weeks in a little motel room with, you know, just a double-bed hotel room, me and my buddy in there, Tanner. And, you know, we made the best of it. We just watched a lot of movies and listened to a lot of music. And,
yeah,
you know, it was almost like it wasn't even real life. Like, we'd start laughing, like, this is so surreal, man. We're, like, stuck in this motel room. We can't see anybody because of this, like, crazy disease. And then it was like, you know, we're watching the news, and it's like, oh, this will be done by, you know, the late spring, early summer, blah, blah, blah. And here we are, right?
And here we are now, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, for you, the story is just so fascinating, is because, I mean, you're like, all through Europe, visiting all these little towns and cities and all different countries, and fast-paced, going like madcap with, you know, a famous Canadian band, meeting other bands, traveling trains, planes, automobiles, whatever. And then, you know, over the span of like 48 hours, you're at the Beacon Motel in Sydney River. You and Tanner hold up for 2 weeks, right? Probably getting pizzas delivered there, and you're not allowed out the door. It's just, it's quite... Go from one to the other.
But the same thing, right? I said, you know, 2 days ago we were sitting in London.
Yeah.
Now we're here, stuck in a motel in a blizzard in Sydney River, right? It's like how fast things can change.
Unbelievable. It's a great story. So listen, I've been, I was on the Anvil site. They've got like 30 concerts booked for mid to late September into October. So all back in Europe, so I'm assuming those are all the missed shows, and they're, you know, maybe hoping.
Yeah, it's a good majority of them, yeah.
Yeah, I guess they're all these dates there and the clubs and everything, so I guess there's wishful thinking, you know, that maybe they'll be back. So if they're back over there, or are you talking about being back with them, or at some time, or are you still in contact?
No, I got all the info, and I talked to Rob on Facebook about it about a month or two ago before they announced all the dates and everything. And he said, you know, like, we need and want you back.
Yeah.
And I just said, like, you know, obviously I'd love to, and I really want to, but I won't be able to give an answer quite yet or anything.
No.
Because, it is a big commitment, right? Because, you know, who knows what I could be doing in the fall. I've been looking at going back to school, different things, right? So it's like,
yeah,
if the timing's right, because it is only a smaller run, right? It is a little over a month or whatever. Yeah, it's like the end of September into like the middle-ish of November or something like that. So it's not as big as of a commitment as the last one, right?
Yeah.
And I would really like to do it, but I guess I'll just have to wait and see how what hand I'm dealt on that, and to go to Europe. He was, you know, no thought. Sure. So that's a great opportunity.
Yeah.
I'm very fortunate. And my other boss at Boathouse, Shelley, the same thing. She said, yeah, it's totally fine. I take you out of the system. I bet you're back when you come. It's like, whatever. And, you know, that's the first time in Canada. It was the same thing. I went to the first show, met them after the show, and I'm like, yeah, I'm playing tomorrow night with you guys, and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, cool, do you want to come on the road with us? We need a roadie. You seem like an all right guy. Like, you know, they knew me for 1 minute. And then, you know, I went to Tom the next day. I was like, what should I do here? I said, can I still work here if I do that? He said, sure, it's only a month and a half or whatever. And, you know, and then I, you know, a year later, I upped the ante on him. But,
yeah,
you know, that's why, you know, I had it figured out. You know, he said, if you know anyone that can fill in for you while you're gone, I said, oh, my girlfriend can fill in for me. So that's, that Heidi, who works at the record store, is my girlfriend.
Yeah.
That still works there. So, you know, that, everything worked out perfect, right? I was very fortunate because, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be able to make that work out. But, you know, I kind of looked at where I'm at. I'm like, well, I'm living home, so it's not like I had that strenuous of paying rent or paying a mortgage or something. You know, yeah. I said, I'm only in, like, my mid-20s. It's like, let's do it. Like, I'm never going to get offered something like that again if you don't do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm really happy I did. You know, I met a lot of really interesting people over there and made, you know, guys that, you know, I still talk to online and stuff like that. Like, you know, friends that I'll have for the rest of my life or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was really, really good.
No, I think it's just an all-around great story. The Anvil thing, it's just so bizarre. And Nathan's band, Nathan Hines, who I've been talking to, is his alter ego is Keith Doom. Keith Doom and the Wrecking Crew. And you got you got three CDs, EPs. It's all on Bandcamp, right? So you can, lots of your music out there to check out.
Yeah, we got three or four releases up there, yeah.
Yeah, that's terrific. And of course, Nathan works at Atomic Records, your home for vinyl in the CBRM. So he's the guy behind the counter giving you good recommendations and spinning the turntable there. So drop in and say hello sometime. Talk Anvil with Nathan. Nathan, thanks very much for this.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. This is great.
Okay. Good luck in future endeavors. We'll see you in the record store.
Yes, we'll see you out there. Thank you.
That's all for Dialogue this week on The Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue three times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of The Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.